This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, hundreds of Australians to be brought home from the coronavirus cruise ship, but another 2 weeks in quarantine awaits them in Darwin. Also, the end of the road for Holden, the beloved car brand, is to disappear after plummeting sales in Australia.
You know, it was 29th of November 1948 when Ben Chipley, with the first Holden rolled off the production line at Fisherman's Bend, that said, you know, here's Australia's car, she's a beaut.
A bit of nostalgia. Also, the ABC loses its attempt to quash the AFP warrant used to raid the broadcaster's headquarters. The Journalists' Union labels it a blow for democracy. Details ahead on PM. Well, they're coming home at last, but it's still going to be a while before they sleep in their own beds. Australian passengers aboard the virus-ridden cruise ship, the Diamond Princess, will be evacuated from Japan, where the vessel has been docked for the last fortnight. But even though they've been quarantined for 2 weeks on board the ship, another two-week quarantine awaits them here in Australia. Here's political reporter Tom Eagledon.
Almost 2 weeks ago, Japanese authorities in the city of Yokohama quarantined the Diamond Princess, restricting hundreds of passengers and crew to their quarters. Now, for the more than 200 Australians on board, hope that their ordeal will soon end. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, convened a meeting this afternoon of the National Security Committee of Cabinet.
What we have agreed to do today is to take action to provide direct assistance to those who are on that vessel by providing for an assisted departure flight from Japan to Australia on this Wednesday.
But the 2 weeks that the Diamond Princess passengers will have already spent in quarantine on board won't count so far as Australian medical authorities are concerned.
Because of the nature of the quarantine not being able to be assured, for those more than 200 Australians who will be returning to Australia, we are going to have to require a further 14-day quarantine period to be put in place on their return to Darwin, where they will be accommodated at the Howard Springs facility.
Brendan Murphy is the government's chief medical officer. He says now that there are more than 350 passengers infected with the virus, there's no assurance the onboard quarantine has worked.
We're not quite sure why there have been ongoing infections, but given that there has been recent cases, we cannot be absolutely sure that any of the currently well people on the ship who are coming home on Wednesday are not carrying the virus.
Now, I understand that those who are on board will feel very frustrated about this, as will their family members. Indeed, I'm very frustrated about it.
Foreign Minister Maurice Payne says consular staff are now in touch with passengers.
All our passengers are being contacted with a package of information by consular officials to make arrangements for their return to Australia and to ensure that they're fully informed about the options that the Prime Minister has set out.
The news is a mixed blessing for the passengers and their families.
We are still unclear as to whether either my mother or my father will be evacuated.
Erica Cretney's parents were aboard the cruise ship. Now her father's in a Japanese hospital because he's among the 24 Australian passengers infected with what's now being called the COVID-19 virus. Her mother's still on the ship.
My mother was also advised when my father departed her room last Wednesday that she would have to serve another 2 weeks in quarantine on the ship. So that was 2 weeks from last Wednesday. So whether or not they're going to allow her on board this flight on Wednesday is also unclear.
Have you had a chance to talk to your parents, admittedly before this announcement, about the likely options and what they will do?
Yes, they were both obviously very keen to be able to come home if they have that opportunity. We're also unclear, even if my father is discharged in Japan, whether he will still have to then serve the 14 days in Australia quarantine.
The evacuation order comes as questions persist about the spread of the virus. This afternoon, Chinese authorities placed the 500 million strong city of Shaogan into lockdown, banning residents from leaving their homes unless engaged in fighting the epidemic. Shaogan is the second biggest city in the central province of Hubei, whose capital, Wuhan, is the epicentre of the outbreak. The move's a sign Chinese authorities are continuing to struggle to contain the virus as the official death toll pushes toward 1,800 people. But China's ambassador to Australia, Cheng Jingye, told Sky News the government's doing all that it can.
Thanks to those arduous tireless efforts, we are making good progress. Generally speaking, as I see it, the epidemic is under control.
China's ambassador to Australia, Cheng Jingyu, with Tom Eagledon there. Well, the virus is testing the authoritarian model of government under China's President Xi Jinping. Some citizens are openly denouncing their leadership and demanding accountability. They clearly do not agree with the ambassador's view. A rallying point has been the death from COVID-19 of Dr. Li Wenliang, who was silenced when he blew the whistle about a new virus last December. On Friday, a group of academics wrote an open letter to the National People's Congress declaring Dr. Li was a victim of speech suppression and saying the right to freedom of speech starts today. I've been speaking with Mike Chinoy. He was the longtime CNN correspondent in Beijing. He's an author and is now with the University of Southern California, US-China Institute.
I think there are a lot of questions about the way Xi Jinping has handled the crisis. Of course, a lot is going to depend on how this plays out. If a month from now it looks like things are under control, the number of infections is dropping, and the general prognosis is more encouraging, then the Chinese Communist Party will certainly spin this as under Xi Jinping's leadership, China managed to deal with a very scary epidemic. But we don't know that yet. And so I think the jury is still out at this point, but certainly a lot of doubts have been raised about the way Xi Jinping's general approach to governance, a very harsh authoritarian approach, has been used in a situation that doesn't lend itself to that kind of approach.
Mm. And there's been a lot of anger publicly expressed as well, open dissent leaking out from normally sort of very closed Chinese space, hasn't there? Some are really not holding back. Can that genie be put back in the bottle?
The Chinese Communist Party has weathered all kinds of challenges over the years, so I think it's important to keep that perspective. But Xi Jinping's model of governance in the last few years has been one of increasingly tight control over the country in almost every aspect, and pulling more and more power to him. And so what you're now seeing, this remarkable phenomenon of people openly complaining about lack of transparency, about the need for more information. And that, I think, does pose a challenge to Xi's whole model of governance. It's clear that the normal toolkit that the Chinese Communist Party applies in crises, which is tighter control, intimidation, locking up people who are seen to be posing a threat, that doesn't work with the virus.
And you mentioned the very sort of centralized approach that Xi Jinping has adopted. Do you think he and the party are capable of learning the lessons and maybe changing some structural aspects of how they work? I mean, is that even vaguely on the agenda?
In 2003, there was the SARS outbreak, which was covered up by the Chinese authorities for several weeks. And after that outbreak, the talk was that the Chinese government had learned its lesson and they would do better this time. But the evidence seems to be that in the first 3 weeks of January, when the Communist Party and Xi himself, by their own admission, knew that this virus was spreading, they were saying almost nothing publicly. In fact, in Wuhan, at the epicenter of the virus, the local Communist Party organized a giant sort of banquet involving tens of thousands of people when they should have been telling people not to congregate. It's not at all clear that they've learned the lesson. And indeed, the response of the system has been draconian measures to curb movement, but not a corresponding degree of openness about what's going on.
Now, there's been a key personnel change in the past week in Wuhan, where the mayor has been ousted in favour of the mayor of Shanghai. How do you read that decision?
The mayor of Shanghai is known as a Xi Jinping loyalist with a background in public security. So I think by putting him in Wuhan, Xi is both ensuring that it's his guy at the helm there. He may also want to kind of reassure people in Wuhan that the central government does acknowledge that the previous administration in the city did make mistakes. But whether or not, in terms of concrete actions, a new a boss in Wuhan will make much difference is really, it's too early to tell, I think.
Mm. And the outbreak has also underscored anger towards mainland China in Hong Kong, where, of course, they've been embroiled in long months of democracy protests. Will Beijing's handling of this crisis reinvigorate the anti-Communist Party protests in Hong Kong, do you think?
People in Hong Kong were already very unhappy with the Hong Kong government, and that unhappiness has only increased because of the way in which her administration has handled or mishandled the outbreak here. So you have a situation in Hong Kong where face masks are almost impossible to get, hand sanitizer is almost impossible to get. And so I think that when this outbreak finally subsides, there's going to be a big upsurge in discontent that is going to cross the political barriers that we had last year. So I think it's very damaging for the Hong Kong government, and of course it's going to accentuate this sense of differentness between Hong Kong and mainland China.
Mark Chinoy, very good to speak with you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Chinoy, who's a former CNN correspondent in Beijing, currently in Hong Kong. You're listening to PM. We are on the radio, on the ABC Listen app as well, and you can get us as a podcast. I'm Linda Mottram on Twitter. I'm at Linda Mottram. Ahead, another blow to the future of many towns as fire victims consider walking away rather than face the grind of rebuilding.
We've just come out here to salvage what we can from the ruins. It's too much for me to manage the whole rebuild. It's time for me to downsize and sort of move on.
Well, the final nail has been hammered into the coffin of the brand name Holden today. General Motors, its American parent company, has announced it'll be winding down operations in Australia and retiring what for some was a keystone of Australia's identity and a one-time giant of Australian manufacturing. Around 600 jobs will be lost, just the latest in a long story of decline for Australian vehicle manufacturing, with the federal government saying it was caught off guard. Alex Tai reports on Holden's road from icon to oblivion.
We love football meat, pies, kangaroos and Holden cars. Football meat, pies, kangaroos and Holden cars.
That's football.
It was an iconic jingle for an iconic Australian brand. Holden dominated the Australian car industry throughout the 20th century and was a top-selling car brand in Australia until as recently as 2002. Gerald McDornan is a Holden superfan and worked with the company's motorsport program for 17 years.
You know, it was 29th of November 1948 when Ben Chifley, with the first Holden, rolled off the production line at Fisherman's Bend that said, you know, here's Australia's car, she's a beaut.
Well, you sure sound like Australia to me.
We are!
It was easy to forget that it was all based on an American company.
We love baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, Chevrolet, baseball, hot dogs.
And now that American giant behind Holden, General Motors, has announced that Holden will go.
GM assessed the investment required, including that for future product, over their next few years and beyond the current business plan, for Holden to rebound and be competitive and sustainable in the long term. Regrettably, despite the tireless work of many good people, the business case could not meet GM's investment thresholds.
3 years ago, Holden and Toyota were the last manufacturers to stop making cars in Australia. Holden kept jobs in engineering and design. Today, most of those jobs will go, around 600 of them, and the Holden brand will be retired. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, says he was disappointed but not surprised by the decision.
Of course I'm disappointed, not surprised, but I think the fact that they took money from Australian taxpayers for all those years just to let the Holden brand wither on their watch, I think is disappointing. And I think at the end of the day, it showed that throwing all that taxpayers' money at them, at the end of the day, they were never going to respect it.
Scott Morrison says the company should have the share of the blame for the closure of the Holden brand. Earlier today, Karen Andrews, the Minister for Industry, says the government was blindsided by the announcement and were only told of the decision a few hours before it was made public. It's a stark contrast to 2013, with some saying that the departure of General Motors from Australia was guaranteed after then-Treasurer Joe Hockey dared the company to come clean on its plans for car making in Australia.
And why are we in a position today where the third manufacturer, Holden, is refusing to confirm it is around for the long term, even though there is an additional $1 billion on the table?
He even went as far as to dare them to leave. And shortly afterwards, Holden did exactly that, closing its manufacturing in 2017, citing the high Aussie dollar and high costs of production in Australia. But there are also those who place plenty of blame on Holden's recent marketing decisions. Gerald McDonald, the Holden superfan.
Rather than encapsulate or put their arms around Holden's loyal customers and show them love and show them appreciation, they said, no, we're going to be prestigious and we're going to chase after the Mercedes market. And they got their market wrong. And as I said, they should hang their heads in shame.
So what happens now? Holden says that it will look after those employees who are being laid off, but it will be leaving a gap in Australia's culture. Royce Kermelovs is the author of The Death of Holden, about the 2017 closure of the company's manufacturing plant.
The Holden brand has existed in Australia for something like 150 years. It began as a saddlery on King William Street in Adelaide, and it just developed since then. The best way of summing it up is the Holden car was our car. It was the car that we made, that we drove. That for many symbolizes their ability to be independent and to, and to be able to move in a country that is so vast. And so when we lose a car like this, this is what people think of and this is what people find shocking.
Yeah, and now it's gone.
Royce Kermelovs is the author of The Death of Holden, speaking with Alex Tye, and I personally have strains of Kingswood Country floating through my head. The ABC is warning a court decision against it today is a win for secrecy and lack of accountability. The federal court threw out a challenge by the public broadcaster to the validity of the warrant that allowed the Australian Federal Police to raid our headquarters in June last year. The AFP was after material relating to the 2017 7:30 story called The Afghan Files, which investigated allegations that Australian soldiers had been involved in war crimes. In response, the Journalists' Union is urging Australians to lobby their MPs to protect press freedom. Samantha Donovan prepared this report.
A remarkable story is happening in Australia right now that raises real questions about the ethics of the Australian government.
The AFP's raid on the national broadcaster last year stunned not only the ABC itself, but media outlets worldwide, like CNN.
The images of police poring over private emails inside the offices of a major broadcaster are not something we often see in a free democratic society.
The ABC challenged the validity of the AFP's warrant in the federal court, arguing it was unreasonable and too broad in scope. But today, federal court judge Wendy Abraham dismissed the case and ordered the ABC to pay costs. The head of the ABC's investigations unit, John Lyons, says it's a bad day for journalism.
This wouldn't be allowed to happen in the United States, Germany, France, the UK. Why should it be happening here? 18 months later, we have two honest journalists who did an honest story for the 7:30 report who still face possible criminal charges.
Mr. Lyons rejects the AFP's argument that the case is a matter of national security.
If it was a national security issue, the story, as they claim, why did they wait a year and a half to 2 years before they moved? It was essentially trying to track down a whistleblower. My question for the Commissioner of the Federal Police, Rhys Kershaw, today is quite simple. How were you able to conclude an investigation so quickly into Angus Taylor, a senior minister, and yet 18 months later, two ABC journalists are twisting in the wind?
The Journalists' Union, the MEAA, says it's disappointed but not surprised by the federal court's decision. Marcus Strom is the federal president of the union's media division.
The nature of the laws in Australia means that it's very easy for the government to try and intimidate and muzzle reporting in the public interest on areas it considers to be sensitive, such as national security.
In light, then, of the raids and now this decision, what needs to change?
What MEA and also our partners in the Right to Know Coalition are campaigning for is a change to the law to bring in a positive protection for reporting in the public interest. At present, there is no such positive protection. What we have is cases like this where warrants and arrests or investigations can happen, and then it's the burden of the media organisation or the journalist to prove that what they did has been in the public interest. We want to see that flipped on its head so that reporting in the public interest has positive protection by law.
Marcus Strom says the Journalists' Union will continue to lobby Parliament to change the law to ensure journalism isn't a crime.
We still haven't lost hope that there will be changes made through the legislative process. We're also urging people to contact their MPs to really put pressure on the government so that the laws reflect what we think are the standards expected in Australian society.
The Attorney-General, Christian Porter, and the Home Affairs Minister, Peter Dutton, declined PM's request for an interview. The Shadow Attorney-General is Mark Dreyfus.
We think the law needs to be changed so that there is such a protection, that there is protection for public interest journalism and the public's right to know, and it'll be changes that would require that seeking search warrants, in pursuing journalists in any way, there needs to be formal consideration of the role that journalism plays in our society.
National security laws have been drafted by both Coalition and Labor governments since around 2001. What's gone wrong to leave press freedom so under threat in Australia?
I think in part it comes down to the way in which governments exercise discretions, because it's not just what the legislation says that matters here. There's a choice that governments can make. If you are pursuing a leak, you can decide that the target of your investigation needs to be the leaker, particularly if that's perhaps a high-level public servant that has breached confidentiality. But this government seems to think that going after journalists is the first thing that they should do.
The AFP says it respects the decision of the Federal Court but won't be making any further comment as the investigation is continuing.
Samantha Donovan. Well, a constant theme of the ongoing Aged Care Royal Commission has been funding for services, for decent pay, for workers. And now, estimating the shortfall is anywhere between $5 and $40 billion, the Health Services Union is launching a campaign for a universal Medicare-style levy to fund that shortfall. But an expert in ageing who put a similar proposal to the Howard government now opposes the idea. Annie Guest reports.
The abuse, neglect and indignity detailed by the Aged Care Royal Commission has prompted calls for a new approach to funding. Gerard Hayes is the Secretary of the New South Wales, Queensland and ACT branches of the Health Services Union.
We are of the view that people in Australia, many Australians, would not be begrudged the fact that a percentage increase in terms of a levy going to those who enter aged care to ensure that they've got a dignified living standard. I don't think people have got a major problem with that.
It would be on top of the existing Medicare levy, which costs taxpayers more than $16 billion a year. Gerard Hayes says the union is doing economic modelling on a levy that would pay for higher wages and more staff.
There could be funding of somewhere between $5 billion and $40 billion that needs to go into aged care. So this is something that we've got to work through.
The idea of an aged care levy has the in-principle support of the former Secretary of the Federal Health Department, Stephen Duckett. He's now an economist with the Grattan Institute.
And I think they're right on that. The current funding mechanism is about 20-something years old. And, you know, what might have been right back in the mid-1990s is probably not right in 2020.
A recent example of a new levy in Australia was the disability levy. Is there evidence that levies lead to better service delivery?
No, but it was a way of putting extra money into disability. It was a way of recognising that if we are to have the NDIS, it has to be paid for, and all of us have to pay for it in some way.
He adds that the interplay with superannuation and other structural issues would require extensive examination. But Curtin University tax expert Professor Helen Hodgson says levies are unnecessary.
It's not really going to achieve a great deal. Realistically, there's no real difference between saying that we're going to increase tax rates versus charging a levy.
Is it really just a marketing issue?
Yes, it becomes a matter of how you sell people and remind people that their taxes are going to pay for these particular services that they may need to access.
Meanwhile, a man who once proposed an aged care levy to the Howard government is now opposed to the idea. Professor John McCallum is chief executive of the advocacy group National Seniors.
Having
done a model of one of these schemes in the late 90s, which didn't get up. We're now about 20 or 30 years too late, because we're now going to require younger people to pay for a baby boom going into home care needs and into residential care needs in the very near future.
PM offered the Minister for Aged Care, Senator Richard Colbeck, an interview, but he did not respond. The opposition's spokeswoman on ageing, Julie Collins, says the system is broken and Labor would announce its policies closer to the election.
Annie Guest reporting. Well, there are fears today that people in regional communities and towns will up and leave en masse if bushfire victims give up on the idea of rebuilding. It comes amid a flurry of efforts to get communities back on their feet. The Prime Minister today announced changes to visa rules to allow backpackers to work in disaster declared areas. That's on top of a $2 billion cash splash designed to re-energise drought and fire-hit towns around the country. But for some, it's just too late, as our business reporter David Taylor has been discovering.
Michelle Wright sits on her property in Yatta Yatta on the New South Wales south coast, an area ravaged by this summer's bushfires.
We've just come out here to salvage what we can from the ruins.
This is a salvage mission for Michelle Wright. She's not here to rebuild. She's one of many regional residents who are picking up their lives and moving to a major coastal centre or city.
No, yeah, I'm here on the property by myself, and it's too much for me to manage the whole rebuild. It's time for me to downsize and sort of move on. So I'm just negotiating the purchase of a property in Ulladulla.
The federal government has unveiled temporary changes to working holiday visas to help rebuild fire-ravaged communities. Under the changes, employers will be able to hire some backpackers for up to a year. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, says it's about giving people the confidence to go back and rebuild.
And the way you do that is you've got to build back better with resilience. You know, I've talked a lot about the climate we are going to live in over the next decade and beyond. And we've got to build for that climate, and we've got to prepare for that climate.
Scott Morrison also offered up an extensive list of programs already underway as part of a $2 billion recovery program.
So we're working with the states and territories. We're working with local government. Andrew Colvin, who heads up the National Bushfire Recovery Agency, which we stood up well over a month ago, is working closely with those communities. It's a big plan to get the bushfire-affected areas back on their feet.
Michelle Wright told PM she's received the $1,000 immediate relief payment and money from various charities as well. But it's not enough.
I'd love to see some money going into the hands of the businesses around here, like, immediately.
You're on the front line there, and we've spoken to people who've been affected by drought and bushfires over the past couple of months, and back then the money wasn't getting to them. The money, from what you have said, still isn't getting to them. What's holding it up?
I don't know. Bureaucracy, I don't know. I have no idea where all these millions go, except for what the charities have handed out to us. So I'm not the person to ask where that money's going. I haven't seen it, and I know the communities are sort of crying out for it at the moment.
A massive part of the rebuilding effort is to save local businesses from collapse. The Chief Executive of the Business Council of Australia, Jennifer Westacott, told RN Breakfast it's now on the ground trying to get big city businesses connecting with local businesses.
You know, we can't afford to have these regional communities fail. And business is the lifeblood. Small business is the lifeblood of these communities. We've been around to nearly all of them, to my recollection. Basically sitting down with the chambers, with the local community, saying, what do you need? And our focus is business rebuilding.
What if, though, it's too late and the damage has been done? That's what AMP Capital's head of investment strategy, Shane Oliver, believes is the case for thousands of businesses.
And that could create an exodus of people, as many think, well, I might as well take my home insurance money that I get for the burnt down house and relocate somewhere else. The real issue that needs to be addressed here is the lack of infrastructure. If we're going to locate businesses in regional Australia away from the big cities, which I think we really need to do, the only way we can do that is if we have the infrastructure to make that work. Whereas the way things are at the moment, it's all a bit hit and miss. Parts of Australia, yes, it might work, maybe along the coast, But if you go inland a bit, it gets harder and harder.
AMP Capital's Chief Economist Shane Oliver with David Taylor. I'm Linda Mottram. That is PM for today. You can always find us at the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. That's where you should subscribe and leave us a review too. AM and The World Today are also there, so subscribe to them and leave them a review as well. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hello there. I'm Patricia Carvelis from the Party Room podcast, which is all about Australian politics. In our latest episode, we talk about the ongoing turmoil in the Nationals, plus talk of a north-south divide over coal and returning Barnaby Joyce as leader. It's available now. Just search for the Party Room wherever you get your podcasts or find us on the ABC Listen app.